How are you?
Most people answer that question with fine or good. But obviously it's not always fine, and it's usually not even that good. This is a podcast that asks people to be honest about their pain. To just be honest about how they really feel. About the hard parts of life. And guess what? It's complicated. I'm Nora McInerney. And this is Terrible. Thanks for asking.
And I'm Megan Palmer, a producer here at Terrible. Thanks for asking. The promise of marriage is sold to girls from a very young age. It's one of the first things that I remember being taught to want before I could even begin to understand what romantic love and long-term partnership even meant. As a toddler, I watched Disney princesses who were brave and strong. Ariel left her entire family behind to pursue her dream of walking on two legs, and the climax of her story was just a giant wedding. Snow White was put into a coma by a jealous stepmother, then woke up and married a guy she had basically just met. And I loved these movies. I paraded my Barbies down the aisle of my Nana's front staircase, mashing their hard plastic heads together to seal the deal with a doll kiss.
Welcome to all. You are gathered here today to witness the union of these two people. Do you take this woman to be your lawfully wedded wife?
I do.
Do you take this man to be your lawfully...
Oh, I do.
I started playing a computer game called My Fantasy Wedding when I was just 4 years old. The game allowed me to style myself as a bride and pick out every facet of my fake pixelated wedding. My mom and Nana both hated that I played that game, but someone had to have bought it for me because I was 4 years old. Before I understood most anything of the world, other people, or myself, I was taught to lust after a wedding and a marriage. The event that would be the most important thing I ever did. It would seal my womanhood in stone, etching me forever in the tradition of perfection, property, and being defined by the men in my life. Of course, not that I saw it that way as a child. I saw marriage as a fact of life, the central pillar. It's why my extended family only ever inquired about my romantic life as a teenager, never my academics or athletics. It was why as a child I fantasized about my wedding more than I ever did about what my future career would look like. It was never a question that I would get married. It was when, and as I started dating as a young adult, how soon? Throughout my adolescence, my feelings became increasingly complex as I navigated puberty, my sexuality, my conservative hometown, my paltry dating life, and my parents' own atrocious divorce. Who was I as an individual? Where did I get my value from? And what does a marriage really mean, especially when the honeymoon is over? My life since early childhood has been a slow unlearning of all of these things that were embedded in me. Growing up in the age of the internet and the rise of fourth wave feminism has prompted me to imagine a life without marriage or children, if that's something I even want. I'm still not sure. A lot of my childhood ideals still linger at the back of my mind. They probably will for a while, especially as I reach the age where many of my peers are getting engaged and married themselves. I don't know how I feel about marriage for myself. My opinion on marriage and my desire to have one have shapeshifted greatly over the course of my life. As the months and years go by, I'm constantly growing and learning and changing. Who I thought I was and what I thought I wanted a year ago can seem laughable now. Where can a marriage fall into all of this? And does it? October is what we're calling Divorce Month at TTFA. It's a month dedicated to telling stories that we haven't given enough attention to as a show. Stories about what happens after a marriage ends. Marriage is a part of many lives, and so is divorce. There are as many backstories and reasons behind why relationships fall apart as there are why relationships fall together. This is one of them. Christina grew up in the Palmdale area of California, not too far from where her dad grew up in East LA.
My mom and dad grew up super differently. So my mom grew up in Colombia and wasn't allowed to date. I think when she was like 19, someone had asked her on a date to the movies and she asked her dad if she could go. And then my grandpa told her, absolutely not. Why do you need someone else to take you to the movies? I'll take you to the movies. And my mom was just like, okay, then I'm not going. And then my mom moved to the United States and that changed for her as far as not having her parents there consistently, but she held on to those values continuously. So I think she went on maybe two dates prior to dating my dad. And those dates were like, no kissing, just going out. My dad loved telling the story how on like, I think it was the first or second date with my mom. They were sitting at a restaurant and he looked at her and was like, I'm going to marry you one day. And for me, it was this very strong idea of like when you meet someone and you fall in love and you automatically know, and that's going to be it forever. There's a picture of me at 4 years old, just out of the shower, and I have a towel wrapped around my head. And I'm like, I was walking down our hallway and like humming the wedding song and telling my mom, I'm getting married. And so I think it was something I was always aware of, loved romantic movies and TV shows, high school YouTubing videos, and I'd just be like sobbing watching engagements and proposals. And I think more than the wedding, I was really excited about like, how am I going to be proposed to? And that was like where my brain would go. And I think it was just always something that it was this like lovely little fantasized, beautiful love story. Remember the first time my mom found out I was having sex and then we had broken up and she was like, she was sobbing more than I was about this breakup of like, but you were so in love with him. And I was like, I wasn't. She's like, but you slept with him.
For Christina, the defining love of her young life is a man who we'll call Thomas. Thomas was 2 years older than Christina. And even though they're around each other in high school, they don't really meet until after they've both graduated.
We met in 2009 when I was like turned 21. I like officially met him on my birthday. And there was probably like 2 or 3 months of just like, we'd spend a lot of time together. It felt different. He was somebody that I couldn't get out of my head, and being around him, it truly felt like what I imagined that feeling to be when you know that you've met your person. There was a fun and excitement. He also was very just outgoing and had a personality that was fun, a lot of friends that he wanted to be around him. He'd always been into jiu-jitsu and MMA and through that had built like a pretty large community, and we would go to fighting events, which I had never been into. Like I was living in LA at the time and he would come visit and that felt very fun and adult-like. And yeah, I think really in that moment, it felt like the strong feeling of like, we're meant to be together. And it was a feeling that felt so strong that I trusted it. He was always there and showed up in ways I think that like other people I had dated maybe didn't. He had different hobbies and passions that he enjoyed that I was drawn to and just was curious about this whole world that I wasn't really privy to. It almost felt instant. I remember the first time I told him I loved him was at this super sleazy dive bar in our town. And it was at a point after I had told him, I don't think that we should be in a relationship right now. Like, I love you. And I think that was hard for him to believe in that moment, because it was like, oh, you love me and you also don't want to be in this relationship.
Despite this chemistry, they decided to break up just a few months into their relationship. Thomas was bringing a lot of baggage to the table, and it was hard for Christina to wrap her young mind around.
He was still married but separated, and like they were in the process of divorcing. He had one kid at the time, and I was like, I'm not ready. Like, I can't have a kid. I don't want this to be something serious. And then it just kind of fizzled out. And then in that time, he tried to like reconcile things with his wife. So they stopped the divorce, and then she got pregnant. And I remember one of the first times I had talked to him in a very long time, he was like telling me that he didn't get divorced and he was having another kid. So I was like, okay, great. Like, congratulations, all of that. I remember even after making that decision, it felt like a difficult decision because I just felt this like, I'm drawn to you and I want to be with you in whatever way that looks. And then even throughout moments where we didn't talk, it felt like that perfect love story of like this, like, not unrequited love, but like there's things in our life that are keeping us apart and it's not working right now, but like maybe sometime in a future or in another life, it'll work out or something like that.
And it kind of does. In 2013, they reconnect. Thomas has been separated for a year and a half, and the spark between him and Christina is still there.
It did feel really romantic. Like, he would leave post-it notes on my car. We had this like thing where we would fold cranes and put little notes under their wings and like leave each other these like folded cranes. It felt even more of like, wow, like 4 years have gone by, so much has happened, and like we still immediately feel so connected. And this is like this beautiful love story. And how rare is it that people get to have this like second chance and be in a different space and like feel more grown up and like have a chance at it again? And then things moved quickly. Like, we started dating, and I think like a month and a half, 2 months later, I moved in with him, which meant like getting to know his kids very quickly, which was an adjustment. It did feel rushed, but it also felt right at the time. It felt like, I remember having moments of like, okay, like I am not just committing to this person or to living with this person, but I'm also committing to like two kids. And it's not going to be like a, oh, this isn't working out, I'm going to move out in 6 months type of deal. Like, it, I think in my mind, it felt like, okay, this is like a forever decision that I'm making. But I also don't think I like sat with that enough. I kind of was just like, okay, well, it's happening. And I remember the first night I moved in, I didn't sleep. Like, I was awake all night. Like, I think, I don't even know, but I was just like cleaning everything like a wild person, because he had lived in that house with his ex-wife. And I think that felt really weird for me of like, this isn't really feeling like my own space.
Christina is 25 and sharing a house with her boyfriend and his two young children, ages 2 and 6. And despite the seriousness of their relationship, for the first time in her life, she isn't thinking about marriage. Thomas's own divorce still wasn't finalized, and her parents' seemingly perfect marriage had just ended.
I wouldn't say that I was outright all of a sudden very cynical about marriage. Like, I still felt like, okay, yeah, sometimes relationships don't work, but then other times they really do. And so it was still something that I wanted, but it definitely wasn't something that was on the forefront of my mind. And it was something that I felt like I really wanted to wait for.
She wants to wait for marriage, but she's playing the part of a wife and a mother already. Regardless of the legal status or label, Christina is doing the default care tasks that have been associated with women since, I'm pretty sure, forever. And she's happy to do this. She loves these kids. She loves Thomas. But it's hard to figure out if you want something like a marriage or biological children when you're in the middle of a committed relationship and parenting. And if that sounds confusing, that's because it is.
I think I held these values that my mom reinforced of you get married and then you have kids. And then I like had kids but wasn't married. And then I think probably within a year or two of living together, I started to really know that I didn't want to have a child with him or just in general, which was a weird thought to have, having stepkids. Like it feels, even now it feels weird to be like, I didn't want kids, but I had kids. And I remember one time, I don't remember if it was the youngest or oldest, but they, I think maybe both of them, we were eating dinner and they're like, do you not want kids because of us? And I was like, no, not at all. No. I was like, if anything, you've like broken the mold and like, why would I want another kid when I have you two type of thing? And then I think simultaneously and gradually, I also started to really question marriage and the institute of that and why would we need that? And then I started kind of exploring like other ways in which commitment can be expressed and named with a partner and without needing to be married. I'd had conversations with him of like, I don't even know that I want to get married. Like, I think we can be committed to each other. Like, why does the government have to be involved in that? And why does there need to be this piece of paper to demonstrate that with each other?
Thomas and Christina are happy together, but
there were these, to me, it felt like at least once a month, we were having a conversation of like, this isn't feeling good, or I'm noticing these things. And I think I backpacked and I ride horses. I like hiking, paddleboarding, like just being outdoors. And we would do these things together. And then it, as things like progressed, I found myself doing a lot of the things he enjoyed. And so I like started training jiu-jitsu, and he, like, I don't think he's missed a UFC fight in his entire life. So it was like every Saturday night, it was like, he couldn't do anything because the fight was on. And so I'd watch with him, and it was something I had to get used to because they used to really scare me. But I was like, okay, I'll watch them. I remember during COVID when all the gyms closed, we like put mats in like our den. We like took all the furniture out and put mats so that we could do jiu-jitsu at home. And like, we did it for a few days and that was it. And then when I would ask him to do things with me, he wasn't interested or would do it and would be quiet and kind of like mad about it, like not having a good time. And so I think I had this moment of feeling like, okay, well, maybe I'm just like expecting too much or my needs are too much. And so I had gotten some comments from some of my closer friends of like, you guys don't really ever do anything together. And I was like, oh, like we just have different interests, but it's like really nice to like have my own thing and he has his. And I just kind of ignored it and was like, it's fine. Like when we're at home, it's fine. He makes dinner every night. Like I hate cooking. He like, it's fine. And so I know that I can't get all of my needs fulfilled by just one person. And that's really unfair to do. So then I leaned really hard in the other direction of like, I can meet my own needs.
So she does. She leans into her interests and her friends. She doesn't rely on Thomas to meet her every need. They might not be perfect, but they're good enough.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. In my first book, which I wrote in the months after my husband Aaron died of brain cancer, I wrote a whole chapter about how I didn't need therapy. Nope, other people might after going through several traumatic events, but not me. I was special. I could do it all on my own. Narration voice: she could not do it all on her own. By the time I got to therapy, I was a total mess. I really was. I was spread so thin. I was completely depleted. I had no boundaries. I was a porous, viscous, emotional mass, not even a mass, whatever, however you describe liquid, just dripping all my stuff on other people and absorbing theirs. Am I painting a gross picture for you? Good. Therapy has helped me in every conceivable way. Therapy has given me self-awareness, has helped me identify where I need boundaries, has helped me set boundaries, has helped me build a life that does not drain me. If you're thinking about trying therapy, try BetterHelp. It is convenient. It is flexible. It is totally online. You can build it around your schedule. You just fill out a little questionnaire. You're matched with a therapist. You can switch therapists at any time. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/TTFA today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/TTFA. I want to tell you about one of the most intriguing podcasts I've listened to in a long time. Nobody Should Believe Me is a Signal Award-winning investigative true crime podcast about Munchausen by proxy. It's by author Andrea Dunlop, who looks at Munchausen by proxy through the intimate lens of those who lived it, along with some of the top experts in the world. The New York Times called it a rich and harrowing chronicle of the condition. It has more than 5 million downloads to date, and only some of those are from me. You'll consistently see it on the charts in Apple because it's incredible. You can listen to all episodes of the first 3 seasons right now. It's very bingeable and very important. Go find Nobody Should Believe Me wherever you listen to podcasts.
Christina and Thomas are together for over 4 years, cohabitating and co-parenting. Their lives have a rhythm to them. When they have the boys, it's family dinner every night and board games in the living room. It's shuttling the kids to and from their activities and all the million other things that make a family a family.
We were at home about to go to bed. I was in my pajamas and I was going to be starting a new job, and it was really exciting for me. And I'd been talking about wanting an Apple Watch, and he was like, "Oh, look what I got for you." It was like maybe a week or two before Christmas. And I opened it and it was the watch. But when I opened the container, there was like a ring inside, and I just started crying and he was crying. And I don't even think I said yes. Like, it was one of those things where he was like, "Yes." And I was like, "Yeah." And it was exciting. I remember like calling friends, and it again also just felt like, okay, yeah, this is like the next natural progression of what we're going to do.
Yeah. Okay. The next natural progression. As exciting and romantic as it is to be proposed to, those don't sound like the words of a woman who's chomping at the bit to walk down the aisle.
I felt pressure. It felt like if I had said no, how would our relationship shift or change drastically? And there were certain moments where, when we were planning the wedding and what we wanted to do and when we wanted to do it, that I remember making comments, like when we went to go get our license, I was like, "Oh, we could also just not do this and still have a wedding and no one would have to know." There was no part of me that was like, "Oh, I don't want to marry this person because I didn't love him or felt that, oh, this is doomed." I just think my whole perspective on marriage had shifted, but it felt like something he really wanted, and it felt like I was willing and it felt worth it to be like, "Okay, fine. If this is something you want, I can do this with you and for you."
The day of their wedding, Christina and Thomas had their friends and family over for what was advertised as Christina's 30th birthday party, and then surprised them with an impromptu ceremony.
I was excited to get everyone together. I love surprising people. So I felt so excited that everyone was going to be really surprised. And it was at home. We got ready together. We walked down the aisle together, and all of that felt really in line with like what I wanted. I don't think I thought about what it meant logistically to get married. I was really into like, this feels good now. And in my mind, I want to be with this person. And I was really present in that. My best friend married us and wrote out like what she was gonna say, and it was beautiful. He also wrote vows and I wrote vows, and I remember telling them both as we were sitting there figuring out the logistics of this, I was like, "I don't want anybody to mention anything about forever, because forever ends. So I don't want anything about how we're gonna be together forever." And I was just like, if somebody would have said that to me, I would have been like, wait a second, let's like reevaluate this whole thing. In a way that felt enough to be like, oh, we're not gonna do this. But I think there was still parts that were like, yeah, who knows? We might not be together forever. Maybe we'll, who knows? Whatever, this seems right now.
This is, unfortunately, a feeling I've also succumbed to as someone who has been in several unsatisfying relationships. When it's not working, you're tearing your hair out trying to figure out what's missing, what you need to be doing better. When it's functional, and maybe even enjoyable, you wonder why you were ever anxious in the first place. It's good enough. I could stay a while. Because even outside of getting marriage-pilled from a young age by pop culture, I am also, at my core, a hopeless romantic who was raised in a codependent family. Finding true love felt like the singular quest of my life at one point. I was the kid in high school who walked around silently simmering in agony because I felt so full to bursting with love that I wanted to share. I wanted to pick someone and never stop choosing them. And I wanted someone to do the same for me. This desire to be loved caused me to be blind to the incompatibility I faced in my relationships. I have been so certain in every relationship I've been in that I would marry the person I was dating, even when there were signs glaring me in the face to turn around. I think under it all, in my naivete, I've assumed that a marriage can change a relationship, can save a relationship, can fill in the cracks and buff away the scratches. But you know, and I know, that a wedding doesn't automatically change a relationship aside from legally. Christina is now Thomas's wife. She can tick that box on any form, but their relationship still has the same issues it had before their wedding. And the changes Christina has asked for are not the changes she's seeing.
It started to feel like it was taken advantage of in the sense that, like, we're going to be together forever because we got married and it's official. And through thick and thin, no matter what, you're going to be around. It felt like that, just the act of getting married and signing documents and getting a marriage certificate, I feel like really just for him made it seem like you're going to be around. And even when we got divorced, he was like, I figured I didn't need to really try anymore because like we were married. We were always going to be together. I didn't think you'd ever leave, which was so shitty. And like, I think I even laughed when he said that. Cause I'm like, what else am I supposed to like, even now I'm like, I don't even know how to respond to that. So I think it changed in that it just felt like it was, there was no effort or energy that was placed into being together and being a couple. And I just feel like that changed a lot. I truly felt like I was carrying this like emotional burden of all the pieces of the family. And so it was even like from moments of, oh, let's all sit and play a board game together. It was you guys play. And so it would literally be like me and the kids on the floor playing a board game and him just like playing a video game or watching TV and not engaging with us whatsoever. Or if he did play, it was like, and like you could tell there's this annoyance about it. And then I think that was really exacerbated with COVID and being home and schooling. And it was like, I felt like I was doing my sessions from home and helping two kids with their schooling. Like it was so much that I felt like he was just like, yeah, you got this, you can do this. And this detachment from so many things, not just me, but I think from just his role as like a dad and just being part of the family. And he would say things like, I just go to school all day and teaching and I come back and I'm exhausted. I have nothing left to give. And I think I remember multiple times saying like, it feels really sad that the rest of the world gets the best parts of you and then you come home and there's nothing left for you to give.
Christina is doing what she's done for years in her relationship, finding a way to make it work. For years, Christina has been leaning on her hobbies and friendships to get her needs met outside of her romantic relationship. One of those hobbies is backpacking. And in 2021, she planned her first big trip. A 183-mile hike around Lake Tahoe with one of her best friends.
It was 13 days. It was both of our first long through hike. And I think the thing that I love about backpacking is that it forces me to trust myself and listen to myself and be so extremely present with what is coming up. And then it also is just like a microcosm for all the difficult things and emotions that come up. Like I, in a day, am like sobbing because the sunset is beautiful. And then I'm sobbing because my feet are hurting. And I'm scared because there's like bear scat all over the, it's like every emotion that I can, like, it just ebbs and flows and you just go through with it and you still take the steps and you walk. And so of course there's just like miles of miles where we're just like silently walking.
This is us climbing up Richard's Pass, aka Dick's Pass. The bottom lake right there is Lake Susie that we swam in earlier. And way out there was our first break at the 6-mile mark, Lake Aloha. And now we're gonna continue up the pass. We also just heard a weird noise that maybe was a bear, or maybe not.
And that was like the first time I laughed because it felt like an eat, pray, love moment when she's like on the bathroom and hears that voice like you need to leave. And but I in my head was like, I don't want to be married anymore. And I was like, the fuck was that? Like, was like, I can't think that. And then it just continued to like pop into my head randomly all the time, ongoing. Like even as I talk about it, it's like it felt like, like, that's bad. I can't do that. Like, I've made this commitment. This is what it's going to be. Like, it just didn't feel like that was an option, I guess, especially because it was like, well, things aren't bad. Like, we don't really fight.
But as she walked and mulled over her relationship, moments that she had previously brushed off bubbled to the surface of her mind.
The moments where we did have big issues was like, he went on a business like a conference for teachers. While he was there, my uncle got really sick and was like in a diabetic coma in the ICU. And this was right before COVID. Like, my uncle was in the ICU for a week. He died. And then we had the funeral. They almost didn't let us have it because it was right when things were shutting down. And during that, he was at this conference. I was supposed to take care of the kids, but I was staying in the ICU with my uncle, like staying the night there. His mom was watching the kids. I agreed to go one night to get them. And his mom had just moved out and moved to a different house. And I was asking him for the address. And he got really drunk and like wasn't even coherent when he was on the phone with me and like just was not there for me in any kind of way. And there had been moments before of this pattern where I'm like, hey, like, I think there's a problem with the alcohol. And it was just like very much dismissed on my end or on his end. And then that was like a pivotal moment. And I remember we had a conversation then of like, let's circle back in July and see where we're at. But like, if things don't change, this isn't going to be sustainable. And I feel like I had a lot of those conversations of like, this is what I'm needing. And like, this isn't going to be sustainable for the rest of my life. Like, if this is how things are going to continue. And it feels stereotypical, but also I see it so often where I feel like as women in relationships, it feels like the responsibility of carrying this emotional burden in all the ways of like, even like the care for the kids and things going on in his family and what was going on in my family. And so I didn't know that prior to that trip that like I was going to crack open in that way. Everything I needed to live was on my back. And like, the strength and everything was all within me. And so I think it really just allowed some space for quiet. And it allowed me to trust myself and be brave in a way that I never had before. I think I had always been, and still am, somebody who navigates what's going to keep me comfortable and what's going to be the like path of least resistance. And I was physically doing something that was so much the opposite of all of that. I just think I was so cracked open physically and pushing my limits in all of these different ways that it really became this idea of what is it that you actually need in your life, and what, like, there's, I don't need to be with somebody who's not listening to me or hearing me or like valuing me. Like, I don't need to be doing this life with somebody who's taking advantage and not fully going to be in this experience with me, because here I am in like one of the most beautiful places I've ever been, doing it by myself. And I don't need somebody here to be able to do this and take care of myself. So my friend's husband and Thomas came to pick us up at the end of the trail. And there's a picture that was taken of me at the end of the trail that I think when I look at that, it makes me feel emotional, because it's more than just, yay, I completed this trail. I just truly felt like there was this whole, like I was this like new person. And I remember that night we were all going to have dinner together and hang out. And we did. We had dinner. We were having some drinks, and there was a casino across the way. And he was like, I'm going to go gamble. Do you mind if I go play poker? And I was just like, sure, go ahead. I just finished one of the most challenging things that I've set out to do. I haven't seen you in 2 weeks. It was like emotionally difficult, physically difficult. Like, I just want to spend time with my person. And he was like, I'm going to go drink and play poker.
Christina finished her hike in July 2021. She sits with her emotions, wanting to give them breathing room before she acts on them. Because divorce doesn't just mean the undoing of a marriage. It's the undoing of her life, of her family as she knows it. Leaving Thomas would mean leaving the boys they've been raising together. It's not a small decision, and she explores all of it in therapy. Her people-pleasing, the codependence, and all of it validates that realization she had on the trail.
So in like November of 2021, I started having conversations with him of like, these are the things that I need. And like, I need you to be more present. And like, I'm not saying you have to love the things that I do, but I also find myself like, I'm always showing up for you and things are just feeling really disconnected. And he was shocked and was like, I don't know how you could feel so disconnected. I feel so connected to you. And I was like, yeah, cause I show up and do all the things you want to do. And we saw a couple's therapist once and he hated it, but he did start seeing his own therapist. But it got to a point where he was like, you're just trying to get me to change. I'm not ever going to be able to change. There was a mix of figuring out myself and what I was wanting or feeling or needing, and then being able to communicate that to him. And then for us as a couple to try to make that work. But I think even just preemptively, I was like, what if I'm making a huge mistake? What if? He was like, it's a good thing you have a lot of friends. And I know you have some guy friends. And I know this is horrible for me to say, but I'm really glad that you have them, because maybe they'll be able to meet your needs in ways that I can't. And it was just like, why am I in this relationship if like you're completely absolving yourself from like being in it at all in any kind of way?
Christina had a hard time conceptualizing her own parents' divorce when she was a young adult. The love story she had known better than any other was over. But now that she faced her own separation, Christina saw her parents' divorce as a balm, more than a source of pain.
I have so much gratitude, and I think it was really important for me to see my mom make that choice for herself. I had this feeling of, I don't want to be with somebody for 28 years and then be like, I was unhappy for most of it or however much of it. And it was just a facade. But I think the biggest piece that kind of influenced the decision was they had tried to make things better and had really worked for this relationship to work. And then realizing like it's run its course and it's the end of it. I think it's always felt that like divorce was the failure and that's the thing you don't want to go into. And a lot gets forgotten about the beauty of the relationship and that, like, yeah, we were together for 9 years. You know, my parents were together for 28 years. Like, there's so much not failure in that.
Christina realizes that she and Thomas are having the same conversations and they're producing the same outcomes. So in March 2022, 8 months after her Eat, Pray, Love breakthrough, Christina officially asks for a divorce. She and Thomas are sitting on opposite ends of the couch in their living room, in the home they've shared together for almost 9 years. The fireplace is on, some candles are lit. The house is silent. Their conversation is brief because everything has already been said.
Like, I felt sick. And the moment I did it, it was relief. Yeah, it just felt like I was doing the right thing. I think, like, in my head, I knew it. In my heart, I knew it. In my bones, I knew it.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. In my first book, which I wrote in the months after my husband Aaron died of brain cancer, I wrote a whole chapter about how I didn't need therapy. Nope, other people might after going through several traumatic events, but not me. I was special. I could do it all on my own. Narration voice: she could not do it all on her own. By the time I got to therapy, I was a total mess. I really was. I was spread so thin. I was completely depleted. I had no boundaries. I was a porous, viscous, emotional mass, not even a mass, whatever, however you describe liquid, just dripping all my stuff on other people and absorbing theirs. Am I painting a gross picture for you? Good. Therapy has helped me in every conceivable way. Therapy has given me self-awareness, has helped me identify where I need boundaries, has helped me set boundaries, has helped me build a life that does not drain me. If you're thinking about trying therapy, try BetterHelp. It is convenient. It is flexible. It is totally online. You can build it around your schedule. You just fill out a little questionnaire. You're matched with a therapist. You can switch therapists at any time. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/TTFA today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/TTFA. I want to tell you about one of the most intriguing podcasts I've listened to in a long time. Nobody Should Believe Me is a Signal award-winning investigative true crime podcast about Munchausen by proxy. It's by author Andrea Dunlop, who looks at Munchausen by proxy through the intimate lens of those who lived it, along with some of the top experts in the world. The New York Times called it a rich and harrowing chronicle of the condition. It has more than 5 million downloads to date, and only some of those are from me. You'll consistently see it on the charts in Apple because it's incredible. You can listen to all episodes of the first 3 seasons right now. It's very bingeable and very important. Go find Nobody Should Believe Me wherever you listen to podcasts.
Despite this relief Christina feels in making the right decision for herself, she and Thomas have two children they need to talk to about the divorce. And kids, in case you forgot, are eerily perceptive.
We had to go pick up our oldest from a movie because I think he was watching one of the Batman movies or something, and he started crying in the movie theater and called his dad to pick him up and was like, I feel like something's wrong at home. What's going on? And so we had the conversation with them that night, and the oldest was just silently crying. And I think kind of to me had like an air of like, I've been through this before, really wanted to know what was going on. And for me, it was really important that I be honest with him about where I was at. And so that was more of just kind of conversation of, you know, this just isn't feeling good, which is also, how do you explain that? It was so complicated. And so that was his reaction. And then the youngest, who is always the comedic relief, first heartbreakingly asked, is this my fault? And that was also something that was so striking to me, because I was like, I always hear about like kids thinking that like it's their fault. And I was like, but this has really truly had nothing to do with you. And then after that conversation, he gasped and was like, oh, wait, the most important question. And we looked at him and we're like, what? And he was like, who's going to take the coffee maker? And I was just like, oh my goodness. Like, it was such a whirlwind of a conversation that I couldn't have been prepared for. There was so much sadness, but then sweetness and understanding. And they stayed home from school the next day. Like, we had breakfast, and it was loving. It was a loving conversation, an honest conversation.
My own parents' separation and divorce were brutal. There was nothing subtle about it, because there's nothing subtle about a lack of communication so bad that it sends both parties to the depths of addiction and infidelity. What made their undoing truly horrendous was the fact that my siblings and I had to watch it happen over the course of more than 5 years. We knew they needed to leave each other long before they did. And instead, they chose to sit at opposite ends of the house and scream and thrash until they ultimately grew tired of the act and of us. Seeing their marriage transform from something seemingly healthy and beautiful to something violent and dangerous was like being strapped to a chair and forced to watch a slow-motion car crash. There were ways to prevent it from getting this bad. There were exit points. There were ways to cut the losses. But both of my parents were too stubborn and too sick to do that. I feel immense compassion for children who are in the crosshairs of the people who raise them. Even when adults try their best often isn't good enough. Parents are flawed and blind and capable of more hurt than they give themselves credit for. It's almost impossible to leave childhood without some battle scars. The kids were 11 and 15 when Christina and Thomas announced their divorce. She had been in their lives for almost a decade. The youngest couldn't remember his life without her. And Christina can still remember their last night together, living in the same house.
Just felt so normal and like it had always been. And then it wasn't, which is weird, because I have this like desire now of like, oh, it should have been something monumental. And there should have been some kind of like, this is going to be our last time. And there wasn't anything strikingly monumentous about it, other than it just felt how it always kind of normally felt.
This divorce was sad. This divorce was painful. But this divorce was not a failure. Because this divorce was everything that Christina needed.
I felt like I could breathe in a way that I hadn't breathed in a long time. The first night I slept in a bed alone after being divorced, I had the best sleep of my entire life. I was like dead to the world. I drooled. I slept in. It was wild. And then I remember maybe a couple months later was the first time I woke up in the middle of the bed stretched out, because every morning I'd wake up and I'd only still be on my side. And so that was monumental when I could stretch in. But I think relief was really shocking. I was so scared of the pain that I was going to feel after deciding I wanted to be divorced and all of the heartache that was going to bring. And what I realized is the pain and the heartache was the biggest when I was like, knew I needed to make this decision and knew I needed to do this, but wasn't doing it. Being where I'm at now and looking back at it, there's definitely so many moments and threads of my needs were not met, but not even just that, like they weren't listened to, they weren't honored or like really cared about or talked about in a way that felt like it was like, yeah, you really get me or really are listening. As we were divorcing and like I was leaving the house and stuff, he had said something to me that was like, I think I'm realizing at the core of this issue is the fact that I never actually listened to you and I never actually like acknowledged what you needed. And like you told me multiple times that you never wanted to get married and I still asked you. I was so committed to this love story and I didn't want to ruin that. And I think I really got in the way of the love story by trying to write the love story. And I still very much love. But I think my idea of what it means to be in partnership with someone, that's what shifted, is that like it's not about having this perfect story and it's not even about like preemptively knowing what that's gonna look like, but it also isn't just trusting a feeling and going with this woo-woo idea of what like romanticism and love is, that like there's difficulty and there's hard conversation and true just honesty about where you're at and who you are. And Thomas and I never fought. Like that was something that I was proud of, because I was like, oh, we never fight. And I think it's because there was just so much that was being avoided. True failure would have been just to stick it out versus being like, you know, this relationship has run its course and it's over now. And I don't think that has to be a failure. And I think that's kind of the way in which I've shifted thinking about my relationship with the kids also, is that from the very beginning, I had no prediction of what it was going to be like, even when I really tried to. And so it has, from the very beginning, been a continuous riding the wave and moving through and kind of going with the flow of it all. And it still is that. And it doesn't mean it's a failure if it's not what I expected it to be.
I see a lot of myself in Christina. My parents' divorce has led me to question my belief in the institution, or at the very least, my interest in it. The feelings I once held around marriage are now stale and brittle. I'm searching for fresh feelings, but I'm not rushing them. And I'm always finding that the more I learn, the less I know. It's a bit of a cliche, but cliches grow from a kernel of truth. I'm currently single for the longest stretch of time ever, since I was 19 years old. It's good for me, and truthfully, I'm loving it now. It's making me question myself and the world around me even more deeply. How could I possibly know that I want a marriage if I haven't yet found someone who inspires my desire to have one in the first place? You're never a day older than you are. You have all the knowledge in the world that you have at that moment. You feel like you're grown up, despite the fact that you will, until the day you die, continue to grow up. Our perspectives change as we age. And if we choose to get married, we're agreeing to go through those changes with someone else. But we never really know how people will grow and change in the course of a marriage. You have to have the courage to re-examine your relationships and your life when they no longer suit you. and only you can determine what those changes look like. You're the one in the driver's seat, so don't fall asleep at the wheel.
Everybody, that was Megan Palmer. Megan Palmer is our associate producer here at Feelings & Co. She produced the hell out of this episode. She was not planning on hosting it. And can I speak for you? You were nervous a little bit.
Yeah. I don't know how you do this every week. It's hard.
You got to disassociate. That's how you do it. But this story, like all divorce stories, it was a complicated one. Megan did such a good job parsing out and like really finding like what made this story universal and individual. So good job, Megan. It is divorce month.
It is.
It's divorce month. Megan and Marcel and I sat down and talked about divorce over on our Patreon. We did a divorce mailbag episode. Our Patreon is one way to support us. You'll get bonus episodes twice a month. We do monthly lives, like live streams that you can see, and some other fun little surprises. And that is at patreon.com/TTFA. Thank you to Christina for speaking with us and sharing your story.
It's not just divorce month here at TTFA. It is divorce month across all of the shows here at Feelings & Co. So over on The Terrible Reading Club, we have a great interview with Betsy Crane. She's the author of the truly gorgeous divorce memoir, This Story Will Change, as well as an interview with Harrison Scott Key, the author of How to Be Married. Harrison talks about his wife cheating on him and how he decided to stay with her and try to save the marriage. Terrible Thanks for Asking is a production of Feelings & Co. Our team is me, Megan Palmer, Marcel Malikibu, Claire McInerney, Michelle Planton, Nora McInerney, and Grace Berry.
Our supporting producers are Kim Morris, Bethany Nickerson, Rachel Humphrey, Jamie Zimmerman, and David Farr. Supporting producers are listeners like you who support us at the highest level over on our Patreon. Dun dun. Dun. Oh my goodness.
And hey, if you're dealing with a broken heart right now, we have a little bonus treat for you here. It's a message for the brokenhearted from our sister podcast, It's Going to Be Okay. It's just a few minutes long, and it's from episode 36, Meadow in the Sky.
I'm Liz McCroughlin, and it's going to be okay. I write a Substack called A True Life Built, which is my story of starting over. And this is an essay called Meadow in the Sky about rebuilding my garden when I was starting over. I was in Kenya. I thought I was rooted there, long married, and I had just built this miraculous acre garden. And COVID came, and I had about 48 hours to decide. Borders were closing. Pick a country, Kenya or the U.S. I picked the U.S. My ex picked Kenya, and I got on a plane, and I finished the garden. The day I left, I hung the last plant, and I took some photos. I think a piece of me knew that I wasn't coming back, and I took some photos, and I was like, oh, the garden is done. I'm going to get on a plane. And I did. And I got back to Brooklyn and I was like, I'm not going back. It's time to start something new. And I rebuilt it last year. It took me 2 years to build something new on my back deck. It was finally my project. I was like, I'm ready to root here it's New York, so you don't get an acre in New York, a tiny little patio. But I designed it all. I'm looking at it right now, and it's just starting to come back to bloom. And it was the first time I felt, okay, I've resettled, and I've created something beautiful, and taken what was beautiful of the last place and incorporated it into my life now. And it's my constant source of joy and peaceful place. At the start of 2020, I lived in Nairobi and believed myself rooted in Kenya. I thought I had dug myself firmly into the red soil with my steady job, my newly built home, and the glorious acre of garden that I had just coaxed into bloom. I wandered my wild meadow each morning, drinking coffee and greeting the growing things. Good morning, acacias and pomegranates. Good morning, craggy cactuses and bursts of bougainvillea tumbling down the hill. Good morning, birds feasting on pink grasses and sprays of small white butterflies drifting on the breeze like confetti. How lucky I am, I'd think to myself. This is where I'll grow old. But when COVID broke, my ties to Kenya tore like tissue paper in the wind. When I blew back into Brooklyn a few months later, I felt like a tumbleweed, belonging to nowhere and no one. I hadn't just lost a garden. I'd lost my faith in security itself. I was raised with a deep faith in my own competence, in my ability to shape the arc of my life. I made plans with spreadsheets, and mostly they came true. Achievement, it seemed, was the great imperative. The formula was simple. Work hard, achieve things, feel stable. I confidently stacked one trophy on top of the next. Earn straight A's, graduate college early, climb the career ladder. Date your college crush, get married, build a dream home. Once my pile of trophies was complete, then I would be too. You've always struck me, a friend said recently, as one of the most ferociously capable people I've ever met. I smiled at this, but also flinched. She wasn't wrong. I'd built my identity around this fierce competence, around my picture-perfect home and glorious garden. But the striving left me brittle, hollowed out by the constant strain of holding things together. And if it could all tear so easily, if everything I'd built could vanish overnight, then what was all the achieving for? It's not that hard work doesn't matter, it does. But no matter how carefully you've laid out the pieces of your life, there are reckonings that swoop in sideways and suddenly reset the whole board. When it happens, and it will, you can scramble to put the pieces back in their old places, or you can start playing a different game. Here's the humbling truth of it. My competence built me a gilded cage, and chaos set me free. I'll be forever grateful that I didn't get what I thought I wanted. The word humility, I learned recently, comes from the Latin root humilis, which means grounded or of the earth. How fitting, I think, for the loss of the garden humbled me, stripping away my veneer of control. Yet it was in that void, in that powerless place, that new ways of being started to root. I haven't made peace with change, or frenemies at best. I still struggle daily with a deep need to achieve, to earn gold stars and prove my worth, and I probably will forever. But that is no longer the whole story, and I no longer feel hollow. I've rebuilt my meadow in Brooklyn now, on my postage stamp patio in the sky. I know that if it disappears tomorrow, I have it within me to build it again. It's not the garden that defines me. It's the love of gardening. I can grow wildflowers anywhere. I still drink my coffee and greet the growing things. Good morning, switchgrass, with your sprays of seeds like fireworks. Good morning, lacy dragonflies hovering on the oxeyes and bees nuzzling the purple sage. Good morning, climbing roses, stretching for the sky, and herbs exhaling lemon and mint. I tend my mini meadow, and it nurtures me in return. I no longer see it as a trophy, but as a living meditation. The flowers don't care what I've achieved. They simply offer their faces to the sky and their pollen to the bees. Day after day, they go about the joyful business of living. And for now, that is enough.
I'm Nora McNerney, and it's going to be okay. We want to hear from you, too. You can email us a voice memo or write out an email. The email is in our show description. Or you can call us at 612-568-4441. We are an independent podcast production from Feelings & Co., an independent podcast company. Our team is Marcel Malikibu, Jordan Turgeon, Claire McNerney, and Megan Palmer. Our theme music is by Secret Audio. This episode of It's Going to Be Okay was brought to you by The Hartford. Have you ever signed up for employee benefits and then not actually used them because you didn't know how to use them? The Hartford is trying to change that. They're a leading group benefits provider that's tired of seeing the insurance industry use terms and descriptions that normal people like us don't understand. They're simplifying benefits language, making it clearer, making it more concise. That way, workers and families can find protection that actually fits their needs. Learn more at thehartford.com/benefits.